This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Shonian
and Maya Shone, coming to you Tuesday, August 12th, 2003. A report compiled by the Center for Strategic Concerns in 1984 removes the veil of hypocrisy from the omnipresence of U.S. and European special forces in Africa, of private armies and mercenaries, and of the murder by design that is the prerequisite of imperial plunder in Africa. Secret wars are fought. Hired hands and henchmen are armed and financed to destabilize and fragment each African country in its turn. The human consequences are massacre and famine. The established media sing the siren song of failed states and warlords and besiege our senses with child soldiers, mutilation, rape, and starvation. All the direct and calculated consequence of imperial policies prepared with cynical calculation well in advance. In part one of Target Africa, we laid bare the pursuit of oil that underlies the thinly veiled imperial plans to cover Africa in military bases, the launching pad for further depredation, repression, and imperial pillage. In part two today, we shall explore the pursuit of minerals and the consequences from Liberia to Rwanda, from the Congo to West Africa. Ralph?
The Center for Strategic Concerns and Global Security laid out very clearly, quote, of the 24 major non-fuel minerals consumed by industrial nations, the United States is wholly dependent on imports for 21 of them. This places the United States in a vulnerable position. The major source for these minerals is a volatile region where there is the distinct possibility of major disruption of U.S. supplies of strategic minerals, and that locus is Africa. The purpose of this report is to examine U.S. dependence on four strategic minerals for which Africa is the primary source. We will examine the potential for Africa's suppliers to exert political or economic pressure on the United States and how we may combat this. Little known to most Americans, the report continues, is a second dependency, a dependency potentially more dangerous than petroleum that has slowly risen over the past years. This is the U.S. dependence on these strategic imported minerals. This is an outline, a blueprint for destabilizing Africa. This report is explicit and clear and unmistakable in delineating the necessity to destabilize each state in its turn and to establish operatives, warlords, henchmen, or what have you, to implement American design.
Let's look at these minerals. As the report states, without just a few critical minerals such as cobalt, manganese, chromium, and platinum, it would be virtually impossible to produce most defense products such as jet engines, missile components, electronic components, iron, and steel. Virtually all the world's reserves of these strategic minerals lie in either the Soviet Union, now the former Soviet Union, or in Africa. Between them, these two areas contain over 90% of the world's platinum, manganese, and chromium ores. What is chromium? It's a white crystalline chemical, and it's used in alloys required in stainless steel, tool steel, and high-temperature applications. That means jet aircraft engines and aircraft structural members and all the areas of high skin friction that cover these high-speed ultrasonic jets. Since 1961, the U.S. has relied solely on foreign sources for 100% of its chromium needs. South Africa has the purest grades are in Zimbabwe. The two countries together account for 98% of the world's reserves. 98%. And there's no material that can adequately replace chrome in the steel industry, and no substitute exists in the aerospace industry. Ralph?
In our book, Death and Pillage in the Congo, A Study of Western Rule, that Khalid Ahmed Zaki and I wrote in 1965, We summarized the application of this quest for control of minerals to the crisis of the Congo. At the time, we cited how in 1953, cobalt was produced by in the Congo, 86% of U.S. use, 64% of diamonds, 51% of silver, 34% of copper, 60% of tin, and tungsten and zinc ores, 53%. The Congo is producing 69% of the cobalt and 75% of the industrial diamonds. And as we wrote at the time, the cobalt in the Congo is irreplaceable and essential for jet engines and missile alloys. Without it, the Western armament industry would collapse. A collateral bit of information, as quoted in that chapter of the Death and Pillage in the Congo, quote, "The Hiroshima bomb was made from Katanga uranium. During the Second World War, the United States had a secret agreement with Union Minière Belgium to purchase all the uranium ore the Katanga uranium mines would supply."
As the Center for Strategic Concerns makes explicit, in the event of a shortage of cobalt, the industry will not be able to drastically cut back. You're referring to the arms industry and the production of jet engines also for consumer use, on its use of cobalt without a serious impact, particularly on U.S. defense requirements. About 70% of U.S. consumption of cobalt is used in alloys, and it states with alloys that will not tolerate substitutes. Now, manganese is another prime ingredient in steel, and it's the third most consumed mineral in the United States. More than 90% of all manganese is used in the production of steel, aluminum, and cast iron because it imparts hardness and strength. The U.S. has no manganese ore deposits. The Soviet Union has 51% of the world supply, and South Africa 37%. And so these two countries dominate the world market. The steel industry cannot operate without manganese. Platinum also, the platinum group metals, are extremely corrosion resistant. They do not tarnish at high temperatures, and they make excellent catalysts. The platinum group is important for all military applications. Again, South Africa controls 73% of the world's platinum. No other country has reserves and could even begin to offset the loss of South African exports.
And this goes to the issue of the nature of imperial policy, as this document in 1984 set forth extremely clearly. The critical element was control and maintained hegemony over the minerals that the American and Pentagon arms industry required. The report states the status of the platinum group metals is extremely critical. We have no flexibility. As long as the United States is dependent on nations for the chrome, cobalt, manganese, and platinum, we will be vulnerable and at risk. We have to do all within our capacity and our power to maintain, through whatever means and through whatever hegemony of rule, access and control over these vital sources. Now, that spells out very clearly, as a neo-colonial plan, the apartheid regime in South Africa in 1984 was considered a valuable ally, but not a long-term and stable one. And consequently, the intention was a black regime that would facilitate the pass-through of these minerals and financial sources to Western control. As we've often said, you can integrate the beaches of Durban, but as long as Harry Oppenheimer owns the mines, black South Africans will work in shanty towns and subsist on minimum wages. 60% unemployment today is the outcome and consequence.
And also diamonds. Let's look at diamonds. Everyone considers South Africa when you speak of diamonds, and yet South Africa ranks third among African countries for the export of diamonds, with 10.7 million carats per year, according to the World Bank. More so than South Africa is Botswana, with 19.8 million carats. But The foremost country for diamonds on the African continent is the Democratic Republic of Congo. Democratic Republic of Congo, with vast destabilization by the United States, exports 24.5 million carats of diamond per year. Also, uranium, as Ralph was speaking about, uranium from the Democratic Republic of Congo, controlled by the United States during World War II. South Africa ranks fourth for uranium, although well known for the uranium mines.
But diamonds, Maya, diamonds are the toxic wealth to be found in Angola, in Congo, as you said, in Sierra Leone, in Liberia, in Guinea. Indeed, the De Beers apparatus, the monopoly over diamonds, has maintained its control over the diamonds, not just in Africa, but in the world, but notably in Africa, through the deployment of execution squads and mercenary units in league with the Central Intelligence Agency to control the source, to destabilize the states, to execute oppositional leaders, to maintain a ruthless control. And that has featured every single strategic operation in Africa, the pursuit and the control of vital minerals. Diamonds are the engine for the purchase of arms, the covert operations for money laundering. Every operation from Rwanda and Burundi to Liberia and the Congo that has required murder arms has been funded through the diamond traffic. The operation in Angola that took 2 million lives, of which Savimbi and UNITA were the political instrument, again funded through the diamond traffic run by De Beers, operated with Central Intelligence Agency control, in conjunction with rival imperial groups from Belgium to France to Germany to Holland.
That's right, Ralph. Diamonds, Angola, Botswana, Central African Republic, Congo Brazzaville, as well as the Democratic Republic of Congo, Cote d'Ivoire, and on throughout Africa, particularly, as you said, Liberia, and then Namibia, Tanzania. You can look throughout the African continent and you find diamonds as a means for funding wars and depredation. Ralph?
Michelle Chasadovsky, in an important book, The Globalization of Poverty in the New World Order, delineated, as have others, the underlying circumstances of the genocide in Rwanda and the installation of a U.S. protectorate in Central Africa. From the onset of the Rwandan Civil War in 1990, Washington's hidden agenda consisted in establishing an American sphere of influence in a region historically dominated by France and Belgium, replaying, indeed, the systematic replacement of Union Minière and Belgian control in the Congo by the Rockefeller interests and, under the direction of, again, the Central Intelligence Agency, a series of murder operations designed to displace the former European colonial hegemony with that of the United States. From the mid-1980s, the Kampala government of Uganda, under President Yoweri Museveni, became Washington's African showpiece. Uganda had been a launch pad for U.S.-sponsored guerrilla movements in Sudan, Rwanda, and the Congo. Major General Paul Kagame, and we will quote in a short time from the extraordinary report of Kagame, the revelation of Kagame, had been head of military intelligence in the Uganda Armed Forces. He was trained at the U.S. Army Command and Staff College in Leavenworth, Kansas, and indeed was trained for the destabilization of his native Rwanda through his presence in the in Uganda as a strategic asset for running the military forces of that country.
Ralph, not only the Americans, but the British provided military training at the Jinja military base. From 1989 onwards, the Americans supported Rwandan Patriotic Front, the RPF, and the attacks from Uganda upon Rwanda. There were 56 situation reports reported by the State Department in its files by 1991 alone. And the American and British relations with Uganda and the RPF strengthened from then on. By August 1990, the RPF was preparing an invasion with the full knowledge and approval of British intelligence. Now, this was ascertained during a UN, United Nations Tribunal, presentation.
And I should mention, Maya, that the operations in Uganda, in conjunction with Kagame and with the Tutsi exile leadership taken over by the Central Intelligence Agency, were well preceded in Uganda. I can tell you from personal experience, having spent a couple of years in East Africa during the early 60s, that the government of Milton Obote in Kampala was overthrown and replaced by none other than Idi Amin. Idi Amin was trained in the Kenya Africa Rifles by the Israelis. All of the training of Idi Amin came from the Mossad and the Israelis. The irony is that he was their man in Kampala in conjunction with the Central Intelligence Agency. Uganda was ripped away from national independence through the instrument of Idi Amin, the Mossad, and the Central Intelligence Agency. It was the antedated process of destabilization of the region that prepares for the terrible slaughter to follow in each and every country connected to this tragic series of putches and seizures of power.
Ralph, I think we should mention that in the 15th century, the Tutsi cattle herders had conquered the Hutu farmers, and the Hutus within Rwanda became serfs.
Well, Maya, the Tutsi were a cattle raising people, a Nilotic people, a Hamitic people, who emigrated to the areas of Rwanda and Burundi. And as you say, through their royal family, they were able to obtain control of the land and set up a kingly system in which the Hutu people were largely converted into a serf peasantry. Although it must be said that the Tutsi peasants themselves were barely above the economic station of their Hutu brothers and sisters. And it was the Belgian control and seizure of the area that utilized the Tutsi royal family as a vehicle and an instrument for colonial control and domination of the area.
Divide and rule.
The absolute strategic motto of every imperial power: conquer, divide, and rule.
In 1959, there was a Hutu rebellion against the Tutsi monarchy, class rebellion. We have to look at it that way instead of as ethnic.
It had all of the components of a class struggle on the part of the oppressed Hutu population, but above all, the impetus for the rebellion came from the most oppressed peasant sectors of the Hutu people, and they made common cause with the Tutsi peasantry themselves. And what's especially important about this is it was a combined struggle. It was a struggle against colonialism. It was a struggle against Belgian rule, with which the Tutsi royal elite were identified. It had a class content, and it marked the intention of U.S. imperialism and its European allies to smash the Hutu peasant population's resistance to colonial designs in the region.
When we speak of Rwanda, what comes to mind for most people is the incredible devastation and slaughter and the 1 million displaced refugees between 1990 and 1993. But we must look at the destabilization of Rwanda that took place during the 1970s and laid the groundwork. Destabilization caused by the International Monetary Fund and finance capital throughout the world, the imperial domination, the destabilization of the African continent. During the 1970s and the first years of the 1980s, Rwanda itself had been a country of relative economic stability and particularly food self-sufficiency. It had the best road systems in the region. It had a postal and telephone service as well as electrical supply, and these were growing. The health and education systems were also improving, and the government had plans for further development. In 1984, however, the government of President Habyarimana introduced a program of rigor and austerity, and this suspended many projects. Now, he didn't do this on his own. There had been falling coffee prices and high import costs, especially for petroleum, and Rwanda was sliding into an economic crisis. Now, as I said, this didn't happen in a vacuum. In 1989, the International Coffee Agreement, the ICA, collapsed under pressure to liberalize the world markets, the so-called free market world economy, so that the big multinational coffee traders were favored, and all the coffee-producing countries of Africa that had been set up during colonial rule, their economies collapsed. Now, 75% of Rwanda's export earnings had come from coffee, and the price collapse reduced Rwanda's foreign earnings by 50% and devastated the country. The effect was a famine in the south, with thousands of refugees fleeing throughout Rwanda, and also people from Burundi coming into Rwanda, too. This led to the first devaluation of the Rwandan franc in November 1990, with the consequence of huge increases in the price of fuel and consumer goods. By 1992, the International Monetary Fund, despite what was happening in Rwanda, insisted on another devaluation, which increased prices further. Not only that, they insisted upon a rigorous structural adjustment plan.
It was in resistance to these plans of forced austerity and poverty. It was in opposition to the dependence of Rwanda on the commodity cash crop of coffee as opposed to food self-sufficient agricultural production that the peasants were mobilizing around which the peasants were mobilizing in Rwanda. And these are the circumstances for the instigation of internecine conflict inspired by raids that had as their inception control mercenary units from the intelligence agencies of the United States, France, and Belgium. From 1989 onwards, it is reported by Jane's Defense Reports called Africa's New Look, Jane's Foreign Report out of August 14, 1997. From 1989 onwards, the United States supported the Rwandan Patriotic Front and Ugandan attacks upon Rwanda. There were 56 situation reports in the State Department as American and British relations with Uganda and the RPF strengthened, so the hostilities were intensified to instigate internecine conflict of a great order.
Yes, Ralph. And let's look at the financing of the military expenditure. While Rwanda's international debt was tripling, the money was not going for civilian programs, but was diverted into the United People's Defense Force, the UPDF, which in turn was involved in military operations in Rwanda and the Congo. Now, this is in Uganda, excuse me. This is the money for the Ugandan external debt. The same thing was happening in Rwanda with the import of weaponry. Now, when we look at what was going on in Rwanda, we can notice that approximately 1 million machetes were imported through various channels through an organization including Radio Nili Kolin, an organization that was linked to militias that were used to foment ethnic hatred. And this was according to the files of the National Bank of Rwanda, which were examined by Michelle Chosudovsky. As well, intermediaries and private arms dealers were used throughout Rwanda in order to purchase arms. Military expenditures on arms, ammunition, and other material were the diversion of all the loan funds from the World Bank. Ralph?
Both the Central Intelligence Agency and French intelligence were involved. It was a play out of the competition, which continues to this day and is one of the elements in the situation in Liberia, as in the surrounding countries, of the U.S. determination to displace Francophone control in Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, in Guinea, in Burkina Faso, in Gabon, in the areas that were the traditional playground of French imperialism, the spoliation of Africa under French and Belgian control to be displaced by the United States. In the words of the former cooperation minister of the government of Prime Minister Henri Balladur in France, Minister Bernard Debray, if France was on one side, the Americans were on the other, arming the Tutsis who armed the Ugandans. It was a showdown between the French and the Anglo-Saxons. The truth must be told. In addition to military aid to the warring factions, the deployment development of loans played an important role in financing the conflict. In other words, the Ugandan and Rwandan external debt were diverted into supporting military and paramilitary operations, the prelude to the genocide, which was a conscious design.
Ralph, looking at the economic situation that created this catastrophe in Rwanda, the massive slaughter and the enormous refugee flow throughout Burundi, Rwanda, and Uganda, and into the Congo, we find an article by Uwe Freisek, excuse my pronunciation, a German journalist, and it's called Strategic Considerations About the Rwandan Catastrophe of 1994. And he wrote this on August 14th, 2002, as well as the Chasidovsky chapter in his book. And it's important to look at this because, as I said, Rwanda's debt tripled, and this money from the World Bank was used for the funding of arms. But what it also did was the IMF demanded a freeze on civil service wages and a retrenchment of the teachers and healthcare workers, a downsizing of the civil service, particularly the federal government, the central government, where there were 7,000 employees and 40,000 people in local administration. Now, these are the educated population of Rwanda and provide the infrastructure, the mainstay of the functioning of the Rwandan economy. Ralph?
Well, let's be clear about this, Maya. The information that Freisek provides was presented by him as an expert witness before an international tribunal on the genesis of the slaughter in Rwanda and Burundi, and the full document was published by him in the Expo Times magazine. It is a testimony which is very clear. Quote, while local Arab actors are being punished, the more powerful international culprits go untouched. The events in Rwanda were not an internal armed conflict. They were caused by international intervention from the outside and by design to limit the discussion to the internal dynamics of Rwandan society and neglect the fact that it was the interventions from the outside which set the conditions for the catastrophe to unfold and helped one side and then another side of the conflict to conduct its military operations. The United States, most prominently the United States with Francophone powers acting as competing junior partners, had planned and caused the crisis in the Great Lakes region of Africa throughout the 1980s and 1990s in a twofold manner. Freisek continues, they are fully responsible for the human catastrophe that followed. One, they ruined the region like the rest of the continent through the International Monetary Fund's structural adjustment policy economically. Secondly, they intervened with covert operations to direct, manipulate, and exacerbate simmering conflicts for the purpose of establishing political control. It is this combination that by design led to the disaster in Rwanda in the 1990s. To understand this, he continues, the following strategic considerations have to be taken into account. The events in Rwanda have to be seen in the context of a war which started in 1990 and a series of armed conflicts in the Central African region up to the present. largely founded on a geopolitical strategy of the United States towards Africa, which can best be characterized as neocolonialist. The economic conditions imposed by the international financial institutions and the Habyarimana government destroyed the social fabric of Rwanda right at the time when the war was launched. The events in Rwanda and the region show that the United States was interested in seizing control of the raw materials of the area. Indeed, the October 1, 1990 invasion of Rwanda from Uganda by troops calling themselves the Rwanda Patriotic Front, with people trained at Fort Leavenworth, started a process of devastating regional wars which have not stopped to this day.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Target Africa Part 2. You can listen to Target Africa Part 1 as well as many of our other programs on our internet site, www.takingaim.info. This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. I'd also like to let you know that next Tuesday, August 19th, during the WBAI Summer Fun Drive, Taking Aim will be on from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. with a three-hour special, The Hidden History of Zionism, and the current roadmap as a dead end for the Palestinian people. To return now to Target Africa and our discussion of Rwanda.
Maya, Nuseke's report is detailed, elaborate, and unmistakable. The Financial Times of London described this process that he so well documents as Africa's First World War. It was a cynical designation. The magnitude of human suffering and the loss of life goes beyond anything the world has seen since World War II. A conservative estimate puts the number of deaths resulting directly or indirectly from these conflicts, which were instigated by United States and French imperial design in East and Central Africa in the last 12 years, at over 5 million. But indeed, if one includes the tragedy in the Congo and in Uganda and Rwanda entirely, it is over 8 million people. 8 million lives destroyed. 8 million people dead. Cynthia McKinney, before the Committee on International Relations, described it as follows. The accounts we are about to hear today assist us in understanding why Africa is in the state it is. You will hear that at the heart of Africa's suffering is the West, and most notably the United States, desire to gain access and control of African diamonds, oil, natural gas, and other precious resources. You will hear that the United States set in motion a policy of oppression, destabilization, and a ruthless desire to enrich itself on Africa's fabulous wealth. By falsely pretending to be the friends and allies of African countries, most Western nations, and I am ashamed to say, notably the United States, Cynthia McKinney continues, have betrayed these countries' trust, have relentlessly pursued military and economic hegemony. They have incited rebellion against stable governments. They have encouraged an armed opposition and rebel groups to destroy the country each in turn. These countries have been, in the West, have actively participated in the assassination of duly elected and legitimate African heads of state, replaced them with corrupt and malleable officials, encouraged and have been complicit in the unlawful invasion and dismembering of African nations in neighboring countries. It is a design. It continues. It is responsible for mass misery. The hearing heard testimony about U.S. covert operations which supported and instigated the first Rwandan invasion of Congo and the second one in 1998, and the result of an official U.S. training program called Enhanced International Military Education and Training, EIMF, which were conducted by the RPF government in Kigali prior to the invasion of Congo Zaire in October of 1996. But during the 1996-97 and again the 1998 to the present campaign of the Rwandan and Ugandan military inside the Congo, it was the covert operations of U.S. forces and the mercenaries of the private military contractors such as the Military Professionals Resources, Inc. of Alexandria, Virginia, that played the critical role.
Ralph, let's look at this critical role. There was a series in the Washington Post by Lynn Duke And the first is July 14th, 1998. And she's writing from Kigali, Rwanda.
Under the headline, "The Africans are using U.S. military training in unexpected ways."
And she remarks that Major General Paul Kagame was regarded in Washington, quote, as a brilliant military strategist. Washington pumped military aid into Kagame's army, and the U.S. Army Special Forces and other military personnel trained hundreds of Rwandan troops. While the Green Berets trained the Rwandan Patriotic Army, Lynn Duke explains, the army was itself secretly training the Zairean rebels. Well, we don't think it was too secret to the Green Beret.
Well, actually, as we've already established, Maya, Paul Kagame was an intelligence asset. He was trained at Fort Leavenworth. He was trained specifically in special operations. He was sent into Uganda and as a Tutsi, the vehicle for destabilizing Rwanda and Burundi itself. He has been a primary instrument of imperial design for the plundering of each Central African country in its turn.
That's right, Ralph. It's important to note the destabilization of the Tutsis who were in Uganda, because in 1990, President Habyarimana was negotiating with the Ugandan government and with the under the auspices of the United Nations and the Organization of African Unity for the return of the Tutsi the Tutsis who had fled from Rwanda to come back to Rwanda. So it was at the very moment when these negotiations over the refugees were taking place that the U.S. was using Kagame to foment attacks into Rwanda.
And indeed, we will come to this in a moment, but the pivotal moment in this tragic series of internecine conflicts was the shooting down of the aircraft which was carrying President Hariyamana the President of Burundi, and that airplane crash was anticipated in a Central Intelligence Agency report to be the necessary element to destabilize the country, and the CIA predicted at least 500,000 people to die in an orchestrated reprisal. An orchestrated reprisal that took as its target not only the Tutsi population of Rwanda and Burundi, but the Hutu peasants who had resisted imperial design, the so-called Hutu moderates, which were anybody who was not in favor of this bloodletting and this internecine ethnic conflict when the population aspired to be rid of colonial control, rid of the austerity plans, rid of the secret armies, rid of the corrupt officials who were paid for from outside. They were every bit the target of this genocidal campaign.
Ralph, in fact, 500,000 people were slaughtered as a in the days following the downing of the airplane, and that moves us ahead to 1994. But between 1990 and 1994, when the plane was brought down, the U.S. Special Forces, particularly the Green Beret from the 3rd Special Forces Group at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, were training the Kagame people. But not only were they training the Kagame forces, they were training infantry in Benin, Botswana, Cameroon, Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Ghana, Guinea-Bissau, Ivory Coast, Kenya, Malawi, Mali, Mauritania, Mozambique, Namibia, Rwanda, Senegal, Sierra Leone, Togo, Uganda, and Zambia, and Zimbabwe, and also South Africa. And all this training under the Joint Combined Exchange Training, JCET program, supposedly is to build contacts. But what in fact it does is train special forces for the destabilization of these countries.
And in fact, it is run by U.S. Special Operations commanders. And in fact, coming to Kagame and the destabilization of Rwanda and Burundi, as Lynn Duke reported in the Washington Post, quote, while the Green Berets were secretly training the Rwandan Patriot Army, that army itself was training the Zairean rebels that touched off the war that toppled Zaire's Mobutu Sese Seko. The process is very, very clear and explicit.
So what we have here is the U.S. involved directly in the destabilization, in the slaughter that ensued, in the breakup of Rwanda, Burundi, Central Africa, and now Liberia, and foremost the Congo, for control over the military wealth. Ralph?
Lynn Duke explains and spells this out very clearly as follows. The strengthening of the Rwandan military is a matter of practical policy interests, the Clinton administration declared. Rwanda is an impoverished, shattered nation at the far fringes of U.S. national security interests, but it is not the prototypical weak client state seeking military help. Instead, it is a vehicle. It is a moment of opportunity, she writes, to control the region at large. It is the wedge. And the origins of the relationship lie in the Rwandan Civil War, which began in 1990, again at the instigation of U.S. Army Command and General Staff College in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, she describes in detail in the Washington Post.
Now, remember, this is the Washington Post. It is obvious it to the bourgeois press. And she states explicitly in her conclusions to this article, the United States favored Mobutu's overthrow. The Rwandan camp Mobutu from Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo. The Rwandan campaign inside Zaire was often brutal. The Rwandan officers and troops participated in massacres of civilians. Remember, these are the Rwandan officers and troops that she had detailed had been trained by the U.S. Special Forces. The rebel soldiers and witnesses have said two Rwandan officers commanding Zairean rebels ordered the slaughter of hundreds of unarmed Rwandan refugees who had gathered near Mandaka, a town near northwestern Zaire, May 13, 1997. This was already near the end of the war. Ralph?
The International Strategic Studies Association, on the 21st of April 2000, published a declaration by Paul Mugabe, the former intelligence officer of the Department G2 Intelligence of the National Gendarmerie of the Rwandan Patriotic Army. In this remarkable declaration, Mugabe exposed the entire operation for the shooting down of the airplane and the precipitating of a genocide in Rwanda and Burundi. He documents and he details the Rwandan government as heavily involved in buying military equipment and arms under the direction of the United States. In March 1994, the arms were purchased and sent to Kigali by British aircraft and distributed to the Interahamwe militia of President Habyarimana's political party, and these Interahamwe militia units were trained militarily in receiving arms and ammunition specifically to undertake, and I'm quoting, a genocidal assault against the Tutsi population. They planned the massacre of political opposition leaders, including all moderate Hutu. They were recruiting, with their numbers growing to 50,000 under intelligence direction, an army of slaughter. And the document establishes as well that Major General Kagame was clearly committed to continuing a war against the Habyarimana up to and including the assassination of the president. And it details that the shooting down of that plane was carried out with missiles that the United States had captured in the first Gulf War in Iraq. They were Soviet missiles that were provided to Iraq, captured by the United States, whose special forces now organized these very missiles for the shooting down of the aircraft that killed the two presidents, that put into play the genocidal slaughter, which was already prepared in advance by special forces of the United States authorities based in Uganda, targeting Rwanda and Burundi, unleashing the unparalleled genocide, first of the Tutsi, then of the Hutu, a bloodletting which then became the opportunity for the destabilization of Congo itself. The National Post in Canada, explosive leak on Rwanda genocide. Informants told UN investigators that they were on the squad that killed Rwanda's president, and the United States helped. Three Tutsi informants, this article in the National Post in Canada on March 1, 2000, revealed to the United Nations that they were part of an elite strike team that assassinated the Hutu president in 1994, shedding new light on the event that triggered a prepared genocide, and I'm quoting, of at least 500,000 people in Rwanda. The informants told UN investigators that the killing of President Juvenal Habyarimana was carried out, quote, with the assistance of a foreign government under the overall command of Paul Kagame, now the vice president of invaded Rwanda. The April 6, 1994 assassination, quote, proved to be the flashpoint in Central Africa, igniting a bloodletting in which special operations forces targeted Tutsis and moderate Hutus. The report obtained by the National Post suggests a critical moment in the Rwandan genocide. The UN investigators had believed that Hutu extremists within the family circle of Mr. Habyarimana had killed him, but at the time they were not aware of the role of the United States and of its instruments and its agents in carrying out that operation. The report and the article in the National Post is replete with detail. It is a cynical, calculated special forces intelligence design. It was the precipitating element of the massacre and the genocide that is unfolding as we write and as we speak. Lynn Duke, again in the Washington Post, the U.S. military role in Rwanda far greater than disclosed. On August 16, 1997, U.S. involvement with Rwanda's military has been far more extensive than previously disclosed, including operations and tactical special forces operations that occurred a few weeks before the start of last fall's Rwanda-led insurgency in neighboring Congo, an internal Defense Department chronology shows. And this article by Lynn Duke spells it out. The chronology indicates the training was extensive, and it shows continuous presence of U.S. military personnel in directing these operations in Rwanda since early 1995.
Ralph, throughout Target Africa, Parts 1 and 2, we have shown in great detail the role of oil, the role of minerals, in the exploitation, the domination, the subjugation of the peoples of the African continent. In the year 2000, there was an international tribunal to judge those responsible for the murderous course imposed on the workers and peoples of Africa that was conducted by the Open World Conference of Workers. And in its first document, they state, "One cannot understand Africa today without taking into account what began with the capture and trading of slaves. The consequences are still felt today. Tens of millions of men, women, and children were deported, forced to leave their homes with chains on their feet under the whips of slave traders. Tens of millions died during the voyage. Tens of millions others died when resisting capture or in jail before leaving. The continent was emptied of its living forces, those best adapted for production. Economic activity was paralyzed. The most evolved forms of social and political organization were destroyed." And what is very important that people don't consider, and what European scholars studied, is the effect on the population of Africa. They provide a table looking at the continents of Africa, Europe, and Asia from 1650 until 1900. And it is estimated, and various scholars have supported these estimates, in 1650, there were 100 million people residing in Africa. In Europe, a comparable number, 103 million. And in Asia, 257 million, more than double. In 1750, however, the African continent still only had 100 million people. In Europe, there was population growth, by 50%, and in Asia, the population doubled. In 1850, still only 100 million people in Africa. In Europe, the population had more than doubled since 1650, 200 years before, and in Asia, it had trebled. By 1900, that's the only time you see any population growth in Africa. In Africa, the population only grew to 120 from 100 million in 1650. In Europe, it had quadrupled, and as in Asia. So here we have the effect, first of slavery, the exportation of human beings from Africa. And now we see with the Berlin Congress of 1885, when the colonial powers divided up Africa among themselves and created arbitrarily realms, states, and communities, zones of exploitation divided among them. And we see the consequences here today throughout Africa, with imperialism creating wars of devastation, again despoliating and creating murderous consequences throughout Africa. Ralph?
100 million people 400 years ago. Consider what was the population in any other part of the world 400 years ago. Consider what its population is today. And then understand what the meaning of this has been in the murder of Africa. It isn't just slavery. It's the constant imperial slaughter, the constant depredation, the willed starvation. It is the absolute elimination of generations after generations in Africa. It is the determination that Africa would remain a dependent and vulnerable place. And every single document that pertains to each and every conflict bears out this tragic and cynical and murderous intent. The Rwandan military, the military that was prepared in the United States, was acknowledged in Lindu's article. Quote, a high-level Pentagon official acknowledged that the United States trained the fighters who ousted Mobutu. The Pentagon official said the special forces training was designed to accomplish that. It was a counterinsurgency operation, which was then documented further in a report by Physicians for Human Rights. Linda Malvern wrote similarly in the Ottawa Citizen on April 8, 2000, Betrayal of the Century. A people betrayed, the role of the West in Rwanda's genocide. A detailed and elaborated continuation of the role of special forces operations of the United States instigation, as had been already outlined by Linda Duke, amplified and further documented by Linda Malvern. And in Corporate Watch's important article on April 25, 2001, U.S. Covert Action Exposed, by Eric Turi Mohammed of the Final Call. Corporate greed, combined with a desire to never allow the throne of civilization to unite and become self-sufficient, continues to join at the hip the United States, the United Nations, and the corporate cartels in the persistent war on Africa, a congressional hearing concluded. Representative Cynthia McKinney, who we've quoted before, chairing the hearing on covert action in Africa, the smoking gun in Washington, led the voices of castigation that established that the United States government, the United Nations, the private militias, and Western economic interests possessed complete knowledge of the civil unrest in Africa, fed the fray, their aim to use war, disease, hunger, and poverty, which they've instigated as further covers for continuing the centuries-old practice of rape and exploitation of the continent's human and mineral resources, this article establishes. As late as 1997, Mr. Templesman was named in the ongoing cover-up of U.S. CIA covert support of the former president of Zaire, Mobutu Seko. And this is article by Eric Turi Mohammed establishes more particularly the further genocidal plan that has been placed into motion in Africa. We are going to continue with our discussion about Rwanda and the Congo. We will continue with our delineation of its outcome in Liberia and in the surrounding countries in further broadcasts of Taking Aim.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today has been part two of Target Africa. I want to remind you that next Tuesday, August 19th, we're going to have a three-hour special, The Hidden History of Zionism. This is a new lecture that we prepared recently here at College of Marin in California. Hidden History of Zionism, dynamic, provocative. You won't want to miss it. As well, we discuss the current situation with the roadmap as a dead end for the Palestinian people, and there's an extensive question and answer period. You can reach us at 212-209-2953, or you can write to us at takingaim@pacbell.net. That's PACBELL.net. Our website is www.takingaim.info. We look forward to hearing from you, and you can listen to our programs online or contact us to purchase cassettes or CDs. We'll be with you next week.